Nice to see everyone this morning. Aside from childbirth, in my opinion, being a mother is not hard. We all agree on that, don't we? Well, being a mother is not hard. Being a very good mother is extremely challenging. Somebody came up with the idea that to emphasize the challenges of motherhood, that we should have a new reality TV show filmed in the islands of the South Pacific entitled Outdoor Survival. And here six dads are dropped off on an island, each with four kids in a van. And for the next 6 weeks, each dad is to keep the kids clothed and fed and mentally stimulated. There's no access on this island to fast food. He is to correct all homework, do all laundry, do the house cleaning in their assigned hut, keep completed all science projects, cook all meals, provide school lunches, enable each kid to play two sports, and take each kid to either music, dance, or karate lessons, and handle sibling squabbles. Each man shall be judged on how well he can juggle these things and shave his legs and wear makeup on a regular basis. He will be judged on how well he can make an Indian hut model with six toothpicks, picks, crepe paper, a tortilla, and a magic marker. And the winner gets voted off the island and can have his job back. One man said that when his wife was visiting relatives, he said after 2 weeks of being Mr. Mom, he confessed, "I ironed three shirts before I realized that the iron was not plugged in. I left so much toothpaste building up in the kids' bathroom that I could have pried it off with a crowbar. I burned three pots and on one shopping trip accidentally left one of the five children at the grocery store. Motherhood is not a job, it's an adventure." You see, there's strong and then there's mother strong. All right, you say, this proves that we need mothers. And the family functions better with mothers. But the question that I raise, is there any real reward for motherhood? Is there any real reward? As one person said, you know, my colleague gets paid and gets at her place of employment and she gets raises and goes out with friends and has a lot of adult interaction and all I get is another dirty diaper. She says, "I'm not complaining, but that's just the way it is. It's the facts." Well, maybe there's more to life than some of that, and we don't want to cast people into stereotypes, but the question that I raise, is there any reward for motherhood? Now, I gave this message over in Tampa closer to Mother's Day, but this is a theme that is important throughout the year. It's not good to give lip service to something like this, "Oh, mothers are wonderful," and then say that the second Sunday of May, and then go back to a regular routine. Motherhood holds the fabric of society together. Now, so does fatherhood, and you can't say enough about either one, but the focus today is on the reward of motherhood, the blessing that it is for society and for the family unit, and for the fact that if it is done correctly, if it is done with idealism, that helps not just to maintain a fabric of society, but it enables society to catapult forward, to be more creative, to be more productive, to be more successful. And I think we'll see that as time goes on here. We need to value true motherhood. We need to recognize it in action, praise it, encourage it, cherish it, celebrate it, share it, enable others to have it. We need to know the rewards of true motherhood. Oftentimes, men are not adequate in filling in for their wives. They're created differently. Family circumstances that demand that mothers handle different challenges simultaneously sometimes. Men think in terms of linear projection, one thing at a time, follow a neat pattern. And there's a time and a place for that, but a lot of times society and life doesn't work that way. A wife can be in the kitchen and she can be stirring the gravy, and a toddler can come by in tears, and she can pick it up and stir the gravy, and the phone rings, and she answers it, and she's doing three things at the same time. Men would get a headache trying to do that. I can see myself. The toddler comes crying, I'm stirring the gravy, and the phone rings, and I'm probably, my gut reaction is to say, "Listen, you be quiet and wait till I'm done with the gravy," and then when I answer the phone, it's probably publisher sweepstakes, "then I'll take care of your need." You know, if I have to do that and I miss the phone call, it's coming out of your allowance. No, I wouldn't say that because I'm in the church. But realistically, it's difficult for men to do a lot of things like that simultaneously. Women have made better operators over the years because they can put people on hold and plug in the different connections. If you think back years ago to the old operating boards that were used and telephone companies, they hired many, many more women than they did men. There's not a right and a wrong way to do things. That it's just that we're programmed differently, even from birth. And women are endowed with a maternal instinct that is so powerful, that is so crucial in nature, and is flexible in how it handles different needs. I mean, when you think about it, the maternal instinct so powerful and so nurturing. Just as a spa check, when a child is crying, which parent does he go to, running to? Mother Teresa or Captain Von Trapp, you know? Really? Have you ever seen a child run to its father when mom is around? It's kind of rare, but I'm sure it can happen. But while men can be very compassionate, mothers express it in a unique way. And God has the attributes of both masculinity and femininity that he expresses throughout the Bible. He understands what it's like to be both. He creates both. He's masculine by definition, but it's as if he took all of his proclivities and divided them equally between men and women. And so he can speak on authority on both sides. And he chooses to write when he describes his compassion for other people. It's over in Isaiah 66, and you can see that. And he terms this in the mindset of a loving mother. Isaiah 66 and verse 13. Isaiah 66 and verse 13, where it states here, "As one whom his mother comforts, so will I comfort you," he says to Israel, "and you shall be comforted in Jerusalem." So that's the deep compassion that he expresses, and it's part of the proclivity that he's created in women especially. Sometimes we need to walk in our wives' moccasins to appreciate everything that they do. Children should appreciate their mothers. And appreciation, respect comes from being taught these values. And if we look at Proverbs 31, which we will later, it talks about the men and the children verbally stating how blessed they are, how thankful they are to have a mother that is in the family that is able to spearhead the domestic side of the family activity. But when we read through Proverbs 31, there's enormous latitude that God gives to women. There is no limit to what they can do in the home or as a home, as a base beyond the home and society. So God is excited about the potential that he gives mothers as well as fathers and encourages all of us to develop our potentials. So one of the great assets that I want to focus on here, one of several, is the aspect of compassion that you see in motherhood. Compassion. This is true with the animal kingdom, but is far more true in the family unit. But just within the animal kingdom, this theme runs strongly. There was somebody emailed me recently a picture of a cat that found four baby Rottweiler puppies that had been that lost their mother, and the cat began nurturing those puppies. There was an incident at one zoo where a baby actually being held by a parent fell through the bars of the cage and landed on its back and in a cage with a number of wild animals. And before a couple tigers could walk by and do something to this infant, a mother orangutan ran and scooped up the child and took it to safety and cuddled it and held it. It's amazing how you can see these deep-rooted manifestations of maternal care, even in the animal kingdom. I remember watching a documentary once, and it was on chickens of all things, and it showed a film of a mother hen with a number of its offspring, and little chicks, they were all running for cover because there was a swirling hawk that was nearby. But one of the chicks got confused and stayed out in the middle of the yard. And the mother realized that and, risking her life, turned around. They showed this on camera. It bolted out into the middle of the yard. And as a hawk came swooping down over this chick, the mother threw itself over and covered it with its wings. And the hawk bounced off of the back of the mother, flew off, and then the chick followed mom to safety. Now, I think of Matthew 23, where Christ made an expression that was deeply compassionate over the human beings that lived in Jerusalem during his day. He knew the future. He knew that that city would be conquered by the Romans and that there would be a severe price to pay for that captivity. In Matthew 23 and verse 37, I want you to note the compassion that's expressed here. Matthew 23 and verse 37. Here Christ speaking, looking at the city of Jerusalem, understanding what would happen to it, said, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those that are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing." But here you see the expression of compassion and love. And that's what Christ manifested here. It's what God the Father has felt. And it is that kind of concern that he has tried to instill in the human race, and in a very special way in the maternal side of life, to give to the mothers of society, because they would relate to something like this and they share that compassion in a family and turn a house into a home. Now, if it's strong for the animal kingdom, it's far more complex for human beings and for the God family. So I think with that in mind, we can understand the power of the nurturing desire on someone, for example, like Hannah, a righteous woman mentioned over in 1 Samuel. And let's go over there, 1 Samuel chapter 1. Hannah was childless at the time, which was a huge stigma on society back then. It is rightfully not a stigma today. There are any number of other factors that go into why a woman or a wife would not have children yet. But in 1 Samuel chapter 1, we can read about Hannah, and she was wanting to nurture and to care for life. In chapter 1 and verse 2, it says, "And Elkanah had an Ephraimite, had two wives. Not God's will, but what he allowed at the time. And the name of the other was Peninnah, who had children. And Hannah had no children." And in verse 4, "And whenever the time came for Elkanah to go up to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion because he loved Hannah." That was his true wife. "Although the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival," and that's exactly what the other wife was, "also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb, at least for a time. So it was year by year that when she went up to the house of the Lord, that she provoked her. And therefore Hannah wept and did not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said, 'Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?' And Hannah rose after they had finished eating and was going to talk to Eli the high priest to counsel about her situation. And verse 10, she was in bitterness. It wasn't that she was impassive or, well, this is just where I'm at. No, she was embittered. She wanted the circumstances to change. She wanted to do whatever she could in order to become a mother. And she was intent on being the best mother possible and felt that God could really bless her in that way. And once Hannah realized that, then they prayed that God would intervene, which he did. And after that, if you're familiar with the story, she dedicated him to God. And by doing that, she was willing to sacrifice some of the time. She was so thankful that she would have a little child. but she would be dedicated to guiding and directing his life, to instill a kindness and compassion in him, and help him to be the best child that was humanly possible, so that he could end up serving God under the high priest, who was Eli at the time. And so she was very much dedicated in that way. And very, very grateful that she had a child. And as it turned out, God blessed her with multiple children. And indeed, it says, children are the gift of God, or a gift. When Christ was to be born, God made a tremendous efforts and took great care to select just the right parent for him, the right mother. And that was an extraordinary situation because it would be a virgin birth. And no doubt people gossiped and talked about Mary behind her back, and she had to be strong and to have vision and believe that God was working with her. And she knew that she would raise the Son of God. And as that became more and more apparent to her, she had to consider, well, you know, if to the extent that she understood the plan of salvation, she probably realized sooner or later, you know, I have to be the very best example. I have to do this right. Because if I induce my son to sin, the whole world misses out on salvation. I have to do my part. I have to do it well. I have to be idealistic. I have to be forward-thinking. I have to be as perfect as I possibly can be. That was a tremendous pressure on her. But she approached it with great joy and with great humility. In Luke 1, verse 46 through 48, turn there if you wish, Luke 1, 46 through 48. I marvel at her whole attitude and approach when she found out that she was going to give birth. And Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit has rejoiced in God my Savior, for he has regarded the lowly state of his manservant." She was poor. She and Joseph were unable to afford more than a couple of doves when they appeared at the temple. It's not right or wrong. It's just that they were not maybe the choice that other people in society would have expected to bring forth the Son of God in the form of a man child. But at any rate, he says he's regarded the lowly state of his maidservant. And for behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name, and his mercy on those is on those that fear him. So it was that Mary had a very humble opinion of herself. Who am I to have this great honor? And not just to look at this simply as a challenge, but as a blessing, not just a responsibility, but she certainly understood that as well. So it was a responsibility that ran deep. And she was full of faith, as was her husband, Joseph. Could you or could I raise Jesus and teach him the laws of God and instill righteous compassion and wisdom and inspire him to continue to live a sinless life? How hard is that? What kind of pressures are there to never let down? I just think that's one of the most extraordinary accomplishments that you could find to ever read about, that she was able to do this. She was one amazing woman. Napoleon made the statement, "The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world." And it's hard to argue with that when you see the examples of Mary or Hannah, which was responsible for bringing Samuel, later the high priest, into the world, which was the only hope for Israel because the nation was so apostate. But because this man, Samuel, was schooled in the law of God and had a relationship with God, it made such a difference. He was the only hope left for the entire nation. And because of Samuel, God did not destroy Israel altogether, although he had considered that. The hand that rocks the cradle, ruling the world, having major influence on what goes on, Abraham Lincoln made the statement. He says, "All that I am or ever hope to be, I owe to my angel mother. I owe to my angel mother all that I am or ever hope to be." And what did the angel mother do in this case? Talk to him, work with him, teach him to read, inspire him, share observations with him, instill in him a love of the Bible, instill in him a relationship with God. I don't imagine she surrounded him with Pokemon cards and G.I. Joes and things like that growing up. I think that she just shared her life as one adult to a young adult that was growing up to have a great appreciation for some important principles of life, for an ethical standard of life. George Washington was another one who made the statement. Looking back on his life and his accomplishments and how it was that he was able to achieve what he did, he credited his mother. He said, "My mother was the most beautiful woman I ever saw. All that I am, I owe to my mother. I attribute all of my success in life to the moral, intellectual, and physical education that I received from her." And Abraham Lincoln made the following statement. And I think of Proverbs 22, verse 6, where it says, "Train up a child in the way that he or she should go, and that person will not depart from it." Lincoln made the other observation. He resorted to prayer on many occasions, used the Bible and some of the most powerful messages that he gave. You know, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Different things like that that he would incorporate into inaugural messages or references from the Gettysburg Address and elsewhere. He was a biblical student. He read the Bible every day. He was very, very much mindful of God throughout his life, especially during times of crisis. And he would pray often. He made the statement one time. He said, "I remember my mother's prayers, and they have always followed me." Maybe we wouldn't be here if it weren't for his mother's prayers. This country may not have been intact. He was the right person at the right time. When we look back, George Washington Irving, another person famous in American history, says, "A mother is the truest friend we have." And he wrote, "When heavy and sudden trials fall upon us, when adversity overtakes the place of prosperity, when friends who rejoice with us in our sunshine desert also desert us when trouble thickens around us, still will mother cling to us and endeavor by her kind precepts and counsels to dissipate the clouds of darkness and cause peace to return to our hearts. The fate of a child is always the work of his mother." And a lot of times that's true, no matter how old that son or daughter is. As if this were not enough, Winston Churchill stated, "The greatest teacher I ever had was my mother." And I think that Jesus Christ might be able to say the same thing. There was one social gathering one time where two women met and they were talking. And this one scientist said to the other, "So what do you do?" And the house mom was anticipating a public put down. So she said in response, she said, "I am nurturing two homo sapiens in the dominant value system of the Judeo-Christian tradition in order that they might become the instruments of social transformation to turn the earth into an eschatological utopia which God has envisioned from the beginning." So what do you do? "Oh, I'm just a lab technician looking for the cure for cancer." And she slinked off. Well, both are good answers. Both are noble. But a lot of times society will not venerate or highlight the role of motherhood. It's going the way of the buffalo, as well as fatherhood. Now, we have a society that's falling apart. You read in 2 Timothy 3 where there are so many different problems, and you have to trace so much of it back to the family unit. And when that disintegrates, you have nothing. You have got chaos. And we come up with different ways to create institutions to help rear children. And while that may be technically possible, there is so much that is lost. There's no imparting of virtue and values the way that has always been traditionally true in family situations. And the way of the family is the way of a nation. I think it was Billy Graham. Somebody made the statement, you show me the condition of motherhood and fatherhood, and I can show you the condition of the nation as a whole. So a nation rises no higher than its source. And that source goes back to nurture. And it certainly starts with motherhood and hopefully fatherhood. But for time constraint, we're focusing on motherhood today. And you just can't undervalue that. There was somebody one time who asked First Lady Hillary Clinton if she'd ever considered being a homemaker. A homemaker? With contempt, she responded, so what would you have me do? Bake cookies and make tea? She had contempt for such a concept. And that is how, you know, a lot of people think very little of being at home. And it's symptomatic of our society. And so they want to belittle it by going to the lowest common denominator. What? Deal with diapers and make cookies? Like, I mean, that's all you relegate yourself to. No, not if you listen to the words of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, and other people that rocked this world, that made a major difference. Now, fathers can help with the diapers, and fathers can make cookies too, you know. But why dump all these negative aspersions on one of the most important aspects of human life? That's what Satan would want. He hates family life. He wants to destroy the family unit. And he's doing a good job of it. God allows that, at least for a time, until Christ returns and turns the hearts of the fathers to the sons, Malachi 4, and brings back motherhood to a higher plateau than it has ever been in such a long, long time. We can be glad that Jesus' mother, Mary, or Bathsheba, or Ruth, Hannah, Elizabeth. These are different famous women in the Bible. Timothy's mother, Eunice, the grandmother, Lois, did not limit the parameters of motherhood. Thomas Edison was another one that owed a great deal to his mother. He grew up as a very dangerous kid. I don't know if you knew that. When he was a little child, he learned about the properties of helium and how you could float balloons. And so he induced one of his friends to swallow spoonfuls of a derivative of helium in the form of a gravelly acid out of a bottle, and his friend keeled over him, almost died. Edison tried to hatch an egg when he was a little child by sitting on it and broke it. When he was 12 years old, he worked out of the back of a train and delivering papers, but in his spare time he was fooling around with chemical experiments. And the train made a turn around a bend, and some of the chemicals fell over, and then they ignited and burned up the back half of the train. The guy was dangerous. And his boss says, you're done. You're out of here. And you get those things off of this train immediately. He was a dangerous kid. And he was considered an adult in school. Absolute fiasco, a waste of stupid. He was called that and other things. So his mother never lost vision of what he could have become. So Thomas Edison said, I did not have my mother that long. She died early. But she cast an influence that has lasted all of my life. She ended up, by default, homeschooling him and working with him and believing in him and nurturing him and encouraging him and not telling him he was foolish when he was highly intelligent. And she fostered that and fostered his love for learning, and told him that he did belong in society. Edison says, the good effects of her early training I can never lose. If it had not been for her appreciation and her faith in me at a critical time in my experience, I should have likely never become an inventor. He patented over 1,000 inventions, motion picture, the electric light, voting machines, and other electric devices that we take for granted today, all of his work, and it would have never happened had he not had the right springboard, the right foundation. And that was not provided in his case by the system. It was provided by his mother. He said later on, he says, I was always a careless boy. And with a mother of a different caliber, I should have turned out badly. But her firmness, Edison saying, her sweetness, her goodness were potent powers to keep me on the right path. My mother was the making of me. The memory of her will always be a blessing to me. Now, Hillary Clinton might think it's more important to be President of the United States. That's not insignificant. Being Secretary of State, that's not insignificant. I'll tell you what. If there weren't enough mothers in the past rocking the cradles that would eventually make this nation what it was, there would be nothing to be president of, nothing to be Secretary of State of. If you don't have motherhood, you don't have a country. You don't have a group of people that have anything more than just the basic drives of mankind to move them along. So if Napoleon is right, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, and without mothers to do that, we have no nation to be Secretary of State over. And Proverbs 31 says, let's turn over there, Proverbs 31, and verse 28, first of all. Job, Psalm, Proverbs 31. This has a lot to say about motherhood, but there's more than meets the eye, for sure. Proverbs 31, verse 28, talking about an ideal family. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Sometimes that comes too late in life, but it's in style and vogue as far as God's concerned at any time. Now, that's the end result of certain things that we read about earlier here. So if we begin, it says in verse 10, who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts in her, so he'll have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. In other words, she's very diligent. And when we read through this, you realize there's such enormous latitude that you can have millions of women that are very different from each other that all fulfill the aspects that are spoken of here. She's like a merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. And realize when this was written in an agrarian society that the literal application might be to go down to the market and maybe trade, negotiate, swap products, maybe handmade goods for other unusual goods from afar. She rises while it's night. Now maybe if she works the midnight shift, she arises while it's still afternoon. In other words, you take these verses and you apply it, the principles, if not literally the principle of it in our society today, and provides food for her household. All this is provision. She can buy a field and plant it in verse 16. And from her profits, she plants a vineyard. She can make money. She can multiply money. Her lamp does not go out by night. She is not lazy, in other words. Now, before I say any more, before somebody could conclude, wow, this is really one-sided, I guess the men have it easy. Well, for her to be the Proverbs 31 woman, her husband has to believe in these principles. He has to give her the latitude, the time, the freedom, maybe some money to help make that happen. Not recently, but in years gone by, I've seen a few people try to use this as some kind of unfair leverage over their wives. Like, well, you need to do this, you need to do that. Well, me? We're not going to talk about me. You need to do this, you need to do that. That's just very, very provincial and unfair. But in this particular case, for him to be able to sit in the gates, for him to be able to safely trust in her and to do his work, he needs to have her support and he needs to provide for that. And we had an article years ago that was, I thought, quite good. It was entitled The Proverbs 31 Husband, where the man is able to make it possible for her to, say, verse 20, extend her hand to the poor, to reach out to others, You know, if he didn't help provide for her, to give her a platform and a basis by which to do that, she'd be limited and restricted. So she can go as far as her husband will let her. And it's beautiful when the two work together, and they both are productive and giving and caring and helpful. So while this seems to be addressing her, it's really addressing both. But certainly, if she's doing her part and reaping the rewards of that, part of the fulfillment and the satisfaction of that can be characterized in verse 28, as we've just read, that she knows that she's appreciated and she knows that she makes a difference. And all of us, I think, deep down inside, want to make a difference in whatever we're doing. How would a classified ad read for mother? Manager? Organizer? Trustworthy helper? Example, mentor, opportunist, teacher, taxi driver, healer, edifier, restrictor, restorer, reflector of Christ. The fathers can do some of these things as well. When you think of all of those responsibilities and roles and possibilities, you realize motherhood is not for wimps. And not for people in retirement mode. And sometimes people can... A person can say, oh, mother, you know, you're smothering me again. You're nurturing me again. You know, I'm 55 years of age. You're telling me, you know, when it's bedtime. And, you know, some of these nurturings just don't stop. Or nor should they, I guess. It's just very, very deeply built into women. And it's a good thing because maybe the human race just would not have existed. You know, if there was no nurturing, it could have died out 5,000 years ago, maybe. Satan understands this, and he is destroying the family unit in any way that he can. And it's important for us as a church, as an organization, to embrace what God has established in the Bible. That is our manual. It's our what drives us. And he knows how important the family unit is. 1/4 of all marriages end in divorce. 70% of second marriages do. 42% of the babies born in this country have no father. And that's just to begin. And what has been personified on television is not generally happy families. I think a lot of this started in the 70s with Charlie's Angels, crime fighters with karate black belt experience. You know, people good with their hands. But, you know, there's nothing said about children, and that's... Well, I guess they had the Brady Bunch back then. But a lot of that's faded away. And as time goes on, you see a CSI and other police stories. The female crime investigators, they're a tough breed. Ice runs through their veins. They've seen dead bodies. They know what it's like. Cold, calculating, seen plenty of violence and gore. That's the impression I get in the little snatches of TV that I watch. Yeah, let me see the autopsy report. Okay, yeah, I see. All right, it's just cold and calculating, and it's not feminine. These people this is almost glorified. You know, these women are tough. You know, they can hold their own in a dark alley. Yeah, they can make the cookies, but you know, they don't have time for that. You know, it's a different world. You know, let's quit putzing around with the insignificant stuff and talk about the, you know, crime, and. I don't know. You can see that I've got to build in prejudice against that, I suppose. But, I mean, what works? What works? Is that what God wanted men and women to do? Now, if they have a special gift in crime fighting, more power to them. I don't want to hold anybody back. But families suffer if women abandon their place in the home for a lesser advantage. And that's what it is, for a lesser advantage. And yet many a mother has wrestled with deep-rooted guilt. And I realize that any time you talk on a subject like this, it can reveal a minefield of unresolved emotions. That happened once in Cincinnati at the General Conference. They have these breakout sessions, and the women had a session, and a couple of the women here will definitely attest to. And they were going to, I forget what the original subject was that was going to be discussed, but here you had elders and pastors' wives in this room, and somehow the subject got on to a different aspect of motherhood, and then before people realized it, and somebody mentioned, my children, I raised with a tremendous amount of idealism, and they left the church, and somebody else says, well, you know, I never knew anybody else would say that, but that's been my situation. And while there are many success stories, and I think the jury is still out, it still remains to be seen what people will do in the next few years. So let's not write anybody off or whatever. A number of these people started to share these emotions for the very first time. They'd been welling them up inside because, well, my family didn't turn out exactly the way that I hoped for, and I just really can't talk about it and reveal it because, you know, I feel like I'm in guilt. I haven't done everything that I could do, when in fact maybe they did. But it can be a very perplexing situation. So a number of people, women, started crying, and they said, well, that's my situation too. And they just took it very, very hard, because if you have a powerful nurturing instinct and you want the best, and a number of these women, they took Dr. Otto Lochner's child growth and development, you know, you can raise a child's IQ, which you can. I remember sitting in there in a class, and he talked about raising it significantly. It was one of the most compelling courses ever taught in Ambassador College. But when you're coming out of a place like that, and as it's conceived in idealism, and you're excited, and you're idealistic, and you're wanting the best for your future family and so on, and you want to do everything as well as you possibly can, it's a very powerful drive. And everything isn't always perfect. And maybe other circumstances occur. And it says, you know, train a child up in the way that he or she should go, and when that child is old, he'll not depart from it. Well, you know, that's down the road. Lincoln said, you know, back at the time of the Civil War, my mother's prayers follow me. And that meant more to him when he was 50 years of old, or 45, 50, than it meant when he was 20. The jury is still out, but women especially can be so hard on themselves. And sometimes you think, well, I'm imperfect. I gave it the best shot that I could. I'm trusting God to be my partner and help. And God knows where my children are, even if they're 70 years of age. They're children to me. The definition of a mother, as one person said, is to have your heart wandering around in your child's body at any age, wherever that child goes around the world. And I thought that was quite interesting. There are a lot of joys in motherhood, but sometimes there are deep and quiet frustrations that need not be. God understands and wants, He appreciates our concern and our effort. And we don't credit ourselves for the good that we have invested. And it's a natural thing for a mother to want to invest. What shines through is love. Love covers a multitude of mistakes. The way children, of course, spell love is T-I-M-E. And many a mother has invested T-I-M-E with children. There was a book entitled Children Won't Wait, where the author wrote, quote, "There will be a time when there will be no slamming of doors, no childhood squabbles, no fingerprints on the wallpaper. That is when I have to and want to look back on my life with joy and not regret. My time is short, my time is now, and my children will not wait." Children, teenagers are not to be considered an intrusion of life, but one of the purposes for life. There are different societies have come up with different descriptions for various levels of love. And in the Greek, you've got eros, sexual attraction, philia, which is brotherly love, and then agape, which is spiritual love one for another. And I think it's true, as others have concluded, that just below agape, spiritual love, the highest form of love on earth is the mother's love for a family. Somebody asked a mother one time on television, interviewed her. She had 12 children. Now they were teenagers. And she was asked, "Which child do you love the most?" she thought, she answered. Well, the one who at that given particular time is the sickest. That's the one I love the most. Or the one who is furthest away from home at that time. Again, definition of a mother, as one person put it, a woman whose heart is roaming around in the body of a son or daughter. Nurture is powerful. Nurture has changed the face of history. In the history of France, there were 69 kings, for example. Only three have been recognized by historians as loving their people. Out of all 69, only three. And guess what? Those three were the ones that were raised by their mother. In the world tomorrow, virtually every king, pastor, municipal leader, camp director will love the people as much or more than those three kings of France. Because motherhood will be not only in vogue, it will be preached on and venerated universally around this world. What a difference that will make. Love is the golden elixir that makes life worth living. Sometimes a busy and frazzled mother needs the tender concerns of her husband. Sometimes it's important for him to say those three special words that can go a long way in life, those three words of assurance and concern and care. And I think we know what those special three words are. Let's eat out. Why would you say that? Because sometimes they might need to get out of the house, maybe skip a meal. My wife informed us after preparing yesterday's meal and all day today that it's going to be my son and my responsibility to come up with tomorrow. It's going to be slim pickings, I can see that. No. We'll do it. So another area, hanging on to vision. Society increasingly belittles motherhood. And again, it might seem more attractive to get the pay raises and the paycheck and the promotions and the adult conversation. Nothing wrong with that. And maybe that's what a mother can do, although giving her very best to her family. Economic situations dictate a lot of times what has to happen. The Bible allows for that. But it's still deep. Washington Times ran an article and ran a poll, a nonpartisan poll of mothers ages just 18 to 23. Even at that age, it said, conclusion was that 80% naturally would rather stay home with the children. One mother made this observation. He said, quote, "It is hard for me to go back to my alma mater, Harvard University, to those class reunions because I worry that my classmates will think that I squandered the exceptional opportunities that I had," and she did have them. "However, the family sacrifices are worth it because my relationships without regret are my very best investment." She was fully persuaded. She can become Secretary of State later, or whatever it is. One woman I remember on her own campaign to get a job, and she had this elaborate resume, and she had a picture of June Cleaver on the front, Leave It to Beaver fame. And it was clever, but it was sad in a way, creative. And on the front it says, "Help, I'm turning into June Cleaver. And I'm reduced to writing recipes out and just sitting at home." Well, I don't want to sit at home and do nothing either, necessarily. I don't think anybody wants to be non-productive. But that's just the way she relegated motherhood for her. And it's hard to be a loving mother if you deprecate nurture like that. Proverbs 29, verse 18, is a scripture we've used many times in many ways. And it states, "Where there is no vision, the people fail," or "the people cast off restraint," depending on the various translations. But where there is vision, the people succeed in whatever it is that they're trying to do. And it takes vision sometimes to look past the mundane activities of motherhood or fatherhood, for that matter. It's amazing how much time, regardless of gender, you find yourself, how much time is eaten up with menial activity. Think back, though. The rewards, they're worth it. Just like Edison had said for himself, if it were not for my mother's belief in me, I would have turned out very badly. So she believed in him and his potential. And so did Churchill's mom. So did Washington's. Or Clementine Churchill, who became not just a mother, but an incredible wife to him. He was not an easy person to live with, Churchill. He was egotistical. He was vain. As his assistant, Lord March, stated about him, he says, Churchill is somebody that you are immediately grossed out with when you meet him. He's just awful. And then you spend the rest of your life discovering all of his virtues. One of the statements he made when he was in the Boer War as a young man, he says, nothing's more exhilarating than to be galloping along in the heat of battle, to be fired at, shot at, and be missed. Crazy. Some brilliance mingled with eccentricity. And it took the right person to be able to help guide him without constricting and stifling him and enabling him to achieve all of his potential. And he understood that. Even in his bad moments, he says, at least this alliance goes on forever, referring to Clementine. Now, she was one extraordinary person, and she did a lot for him, and indirectly then did a lot for the country and for the world. We can't underestimate this. You won't hear this in most other places. It's not really taught in school. You won't get any reward from this. If you're a homemaker, you'll get a little statement from Social Security that says you haven't put in enough hours. You get zero. You get zero from the government when you reach retirement age. And so for that reason alone, maybe there's some need to be working outside the home. So this is not a referendum on that. It is just that the rewards that God talks about in the Bible get very little reinforcement of the world around us. And we can't let that dissuade us into thinking that this is a second-rate calling. It's important to have vision, to instill that vision in a child. You need to continue that music practice. You need to finish the homework to do these chores, because those are stepping stones to other things. Tom Landry made the statement. He coached the Dallas Cowboys to a number of championships. And he said, you know, in some ways I find that my job is like that of a mother with her children, because my job in football is to make men do what they don't want to do in order to achieve what they want to be. And there comes a price for success. Is there any reward for motherhood? Yes, if you've got vision as well as a compassion, vision to see it through. Again, it goes back to the interview this one person had working on the Sistine Chapel. They asked him, well, what are you doing? Oh, I'm chopping up some marble. They asked another person, what are you doing? Same work, same type of work. He says, I'm building this incredibly beautiful edifice. Life is what we make of it. Thinking back to the woman who said, I am nurturing two Homo sapiens into the dominant values of the Judeo-Christian tradition in order that they might become social instruments of a transformation from the earth as it is now to a utopia that God is planning to establish. Life is what we make of it. And even though it bestows precious little praise for mothers, let it not be that way here. Let it not be that way here. It says in Psalms 45, I'll just refer to verse 16 and 17, that we are raising as children people that will be princes and princesses on the earth as after Christ comes back to establish the kingdom of God. The stakes are high, the rewards are there. It's still remembered as being valuable in some countries. In Sweden, if you give birth to a child, you get maternal leave for a year. And you are paid, in some cases, up to 80% of your salary. But not so in the United States. We just have to make the most of the circumstances that we have. And they are a challenge, but there is no turning back. There is no place for second best if we can aspire to such wonderful principles. And fatherhood has its own demands as well. and is equally important. But as I conclude here, let's appreciate the fact that womanhood does exist, that God has intended for women to have a very, very important role in guiding the human race, and that it can't be successfully done without their presence, that nurture is not the same without the women that God has given to society to make it work. And let us be thankful that there is divine purpose in this life as well as life to come, and that motherhood is not dead. It is alive and well, and that is something that we ought to embrace and cherish, not just one day throughout the year, but all the days, because it is a lifetime passion and purpose and responsibility.